stepped up to the conversation. He was still recovering from the siege at Brandmount and the difficult journey south. Seeing so many of his friends perish had been hard on him. But he was an invaluable research tool, as he was the only human being I knew about who had grown up in close proximity to it and had mastered its control. I hated to put the man to use like that, after what he had been through, but I really didn't have a choice. The problem with Zagor was he either knew a treefolk term for something, which wasn't particularly helpful, or he would just shrug, because he didn't have the vocabulary to describe what he knew. That being said, he was helpful in advising us on the basic attunement and use of the witchstones. He did agree that there was a special feeling that built up when you used the stones overmuch, something to be avoided. It was one reason why he was stingy with its power, to avoid the addictive properties of Irionite. He watched me pass out the stones with a certain wry amusement, and enjoyed the reaction of the Magi as if they were children getting toys at Yule. The 19 War Magi, plus our homespun magical corps, had assembled on the roof of the tower in a neat semicircle around me, everyone within earshot, as I passed out the magical bounty. There weren't enough for everyone, of course. Beyond the stones held by Tyndall, Garkescu, and Rondal, there were 9 stones to go around, and 19 War Magi, plus Penny, to wield them. I took a moment to inspect the eager wizards as I distributed the stones. Several I knew from Faris, or working as a war mage myself. Some I was just meeting. Professional war magi are an odd lot. When you can make a good living as a trained mage pretty much anywhere in the 5 duchies, it takes a special kind of person to voluntarily give that up for the hard, violent, but lucrative lifestyle of the professional war mage. I guess war magi come in 2 sorts. Those who get off on the pure adrenaline rush you get from charging an enemy line, and those who lusted after the powerful forces involved in war magic. Stuff the average spellmonger or court wizard just doesn't use in daily practice. War magi also differ from non-magical soldiers in that they have style. That is, they tend to go out of their way to make themselves individually distinctive in dress, mannerisms, and behavior, in order to increase their reputations, which in turn leads to more contracts. For example, Garki was gaudy, even for a spellmonger. Most of these mercenaries had adopted garb that was sleek or deadly-looking, high-grade leather, ornamented armor, dashing accessories of polished steel and such. In general, they're good dressers, and adopt an arrogant attitude when they work. I suppose it stems from their unshakable belief that they are superior to any other soldiers in all respects. Egotistical bastards. I was grateful for everyone. The 17 men and 2 women assembled before me wore a variety of robes and armors, ranging from the menacingly stark to the outrageously ornate. Various personal liveries and family mascots were emblazoned on some. Others focused more on clothes and accessories that made them seem more dangerous to the untrained eye. A few, as I said, I recognized. Azar, a slim, tall young man dressed in tight-fitting black leather over loose black Farisian silks, had patrolled the occupied city of Faris with me only a few years ago. He was a deadly fighter, I knew from personal experience, the kind who doesn't see enemies, he sees obstacles to be overcome. There was Wenik, a small, mean-looking little man with a tendency toward portliness and a penchant for plaid wools. I'd played dice with him a few times while we waited for work down in Barrowbell, and despite his scowling, gruff manner, he was a pretty decent guy. His specialty was nasty offensive magics, the sort that make you start bleeding from every pore, or turn the air in your lungs solid. He'd been in the thick of the Battle of the Tower, in another squad, and counted himself lucky to be alive. I was very pleased to see Hesia, a girlfriend of Penny's who had a spectacular knack for disabling defensive spells, particularly the kind that strengthen fortifications. She was also adept at magically augmenting siege engines. Indeed, she loved the things. She was standing up front, swathed in a flowing red robe chased with golden griffins. Then there was Horka, whom the jongleurs of Castabriel had said is a grandson of Duin the Destroyer, on his mother's side. War incarnate, a one-mage army invincible to any foe. I know this for a fact, because I was with him when he paid the jongleurs of Castabriel to say it. He had a nondescript peasant's face, and a quiver on his back that held the variety of wands. His mage blade was a foot longer than mine, and he had strapped daggers to every limb. Penny had mentioned that he had been plying his trade as an assassin and saboteur the last year or so in the eastern duchies, adding a little dark spice to the various inheritance feuds that were the main entertainment there, some of which dated back to imperial times. Off the field, he was a good, if somber, companion. On the field, he nearly lived up to his inflated reputation. Telemann, of course, I knew from the long march down the Phrygian Peninsula. I even bunked with him for a brief stint during the occupation. He's a good mage, good war captain, good friend, with absolutely no fashion sense. He wore a pale yellow cloak and tight-fitting blue leather pants under a shimmering hauberk of the finest mail I'd ever seen, heavily enchanted, and he wielded a powerful battle staff that doubled as a spear. He had a jawline like a mountain, and he was an adept soldier and decent captain, and he loved his work. Telemann was the type of mage who got into war magic because he liked the powerful spells. His idea of a good time is watching stone battlements crumble to dust under a powerful aging spell. He's also one of the few war magi I knew who took an academic interest in war magic. He was writing a book on the subject, he bragged. Mavone was another war mage with whom I'd worked, both in Phrys and in a few freelance assignments. He was a genteel Gilmoran mage, softly spoken but very subtle, not the type of man you want to cross. Of course, one could say that about most Gilmorans, for whom dueling is as much a recreation as a heritage. The others were a mystery to me, though I knew a few of them by reputation alone. But they were an impressive-looking lot, even to my eye. What impressed me more was that Penny had been able to get such a large, deadly group of individuals to come to my rescue on such short notice. They didn't come into this hopeless siege out of a sense of duty, compassion, or obligation. They wanted to get paid in Irianite, of course. That was the only reason they were there. When the word had gone out from Penny, who has a habit of exaggerating just enough to motivate someone to do what she wants, the war magi who heard it had lined up from all over the duchies. In one case, the magical corps on both sides of a lagging territorial dispute in Kestelon had simply quit, refunded their employers' fees, and made for the rendezvous point together. That brought me four war magi. Astrial, Cormor, Carmela, a specialist in castle construction and repair, and the only other female war mage of the group, and Roloff. Enough stories about the mad mage's defense of Phrys had circulated to inflame the whole twisted little war mage community. Masters, I began politely, and ladies. My name is Minilin, and until 2 months ago I was the spellmonger for a little village not far from here. Before you start making jokes about smelling horseshit when I'm around, let me add that I am also a graduate of the War College and the Inarian Academy. I put in my time in Phrys, and for the last several weeks I have been responsible for keeping that horde out there at bay. So, if you feel I'm a complete idiot, please keep it to yourself, because I might just blast you where you stand out of pure malicious spite. That earned me a chorus of chuckles and several appreciative nods. You can't earn the trust of a war mage by being obsequious, but crediting them with common sense works. They were warming up to me. It doesn't take a military genius to see what the situation here is. I appreciate your efforts on our behalf, so far, and hope that you find the proposed compensation adequate. That brought more giggles. I remind you that by accepting these stones from me, you are technically in violation of the Royal Censorate's bans on magic, and may be subject to professional and civil penalties. I'll also mention that there is a dearth of actual censors in the Wilderlands, so your chances of being tracked down here are negligible, and any censor would have to fight his way through that lot before he could attempt to question you. Now, I said, taking the big leather pouch with the unclaimed stones from Tyndall, who stood by, there are not currently enough of these to go around, so we will have to share, at least until we can increase the supply. There were grumbles in the ranks, and a few sour faces. The good news is that there are more on the way, The bad news is that you will have to hack your way through 1,000 Gavani and duel an enthusiastically patriotic Gavani shaman to get one. More wry chuckles. Now, before we begin, I said, withdrawing the first stone from the bag, some ground rules. I have no doubt that you all are far, far better war magi than I am. I am not here to debate that. I am here to tell you that, to my knowledge, I am the greatest living human academic authority on the subject of Irianite since the recent death of Oral Pratt, in that I have had the most experience and instruction with the stuff, and you should listen to me for your own safety and benefit. Zagor over there actually has possessed a stone since childhood, and has received instruction in its use from the Alka Alon. That impressed them. Any mage who had studied with the Alka Alon, even briefly, tended to be held in esteem by Magi. While he has the experience to use it, I continued, he isn't classically trained, and may find it difficult to speak on the subject in terms we could understand. Nor is he a war mage. He's a hedge wizard. He has agreed, however, to sit in and assist in your introduction to the stones. We are dealing with potent forces here, more than you've ever used in your lives. They are haphazard and dangerous. Already there has been one unintentional death, and a vicious maiming due to the improper use of these stones. That caught everyone's attention, and I gave a sketchy account of Uruk's rebellion, leaving out parts that would be embarrassing to Garkescu. The old man was still in a state of shock about the whole thing. I was hoping he would recover. The rest of the lesson was similar to the one I gave to my original magical core a week before, and so does not bear repeating. One item of note, though, was the dramatic proficiency the war magi showed at using the stones. While Garkescu and his boys had clumsily lobbed uncomplicated bolts of pure magical force at the hapless goblin infantry, this new bunch began sending a sophisticated variety of nasty offensive spells to rain down on our foe almost immediately. Augmented by the power of the stones, their attacks had a visible effect on the distant Gavani lines. We all watched with amusement, through mage sight, as they practiced on living creatures. In some places they were stricken with bouts of coughing, or oppressive heat, or a maddening screech that made it impossible to sleep or concentrate. The shamans on the day shift put up defensive spells in a hurry, but they didn't do much against the skills of the wizards. My new magical core was used to evading such inconveniences, and they quickly came up with counterspells. They were like kids with new toys, trying out subtle variations of their favorite spells that were profoundly effective when powered by Irianite. And I made everyone take turns on them. I let them play like that for 2 or 3 hours. Then I ordered them to do the more serious job of erecting a real magical defense over Bovol Castle. The thaumaturgical field, dome of power to the layman, that had surrounded it, was reinforced in manifold ways, as each war mage added his or her special spells to it. When they were done, it was so strong and devious that it could be seen even without mage sight. It would stop most regular magical attacks now, and keep anyone from magical reconnaissance too. Even arrows and missiles flung from siege engines had a hard time targeting any place significant within after they improved the defenses. I put 3 men on harassment duty, making life difficult and occasionally dangerous to our foe by dropping lethal bits of magic in their midst, just to be annoying. That was a popular job, as they could try out theories and iterations of power on a real, live foe. I had 2 magi on surveillance duty at all times, scrying for minute movements in enemy troop formations, and pinpointing the location of our opponent's witchstone-wielding shamans in the camps all around us. That last bit was important, because we planned to hunt them relentlessly. I wouldn't be happy until every one of them got a piece of Irianite, as promised. The rest of them I returned to their tower, where they could take turns practicing with their stones, or sleep. Most of them slept. Some didn't. Telemann, for example, wanted to talk strategy, particularly in light of the approaching force, not the huge army of Gavani, but the undead thing that led it. They had all detected the advance of the old god's avatar, like the wake of a great ship, and worriedly asked me more about it. I tried to be vague about my answer, but they could smell the bullshit and pinned me down about it. So I eventually admitted that this massive power was only days away from us, likely with another horde at his back. And regardless of what Sire Kusi might say, our time here was limited. That troubled them, but these men were used to risk, even magical risk. They got back to work with a shrug instead of packing their bags like sane people. Like I said, war magi are strange. After I dismissed the class, I joined Penny on the edge of the wall where Tyndall had been thoughtful enough to provide a small and simple supper. She was a bit older, more mature, than when I'd last seen her. She was almost 21, she bragged, as she caught me up on gossip from our mutual friends. She looked as elegant eating cold rations in a siege as she had dining at the Academy Solstice Ball. She was still wearing her black riding leathers, but had added a rakish black mantle cut in a masculine style. Ordinarily that would seem an unnecessary fabrication. On her, it worked.
"It's a lovely group I've put together, eh?"
she asked, one eyebrow raised as she poured the beer daintily into a mug. "Comparatively speaking, I cannot argue with that. You saw what I had been working with. A spellmonger and a couple of apprentices. The amazing thing about a dancing bear is not how gracefully it dances, but that it dances at all," she finished.
"Agreed. Min, I'm so happy to see you alive I could bust."
It was the closest to an admission of admiration I'd get from her. Like the war magi, I accepted it graciously and gratefully.
"Same here,"
I nodded, smiling. "I can't believe that you actually came to rescue me."
"To be honest, I did it for the jewelry. Like this lovely necklace," she said,
touching the Irionite bead that had recently graced the neck of the Black Skull Shaman.
"I've always been a sucker for jewelry."
It was more powerful than the other pebbles, I'd determined, and while it might prove deadlier than other stones in the hands of other magi, she had earned it.
"In truth, I came as quick as I could, and would have brought more help if I could have. That Huin be damned little lordling! I had a crack unit of mercenary horse archers under contract, and he had the nerve to—"
"I know, I know," I said, putting up a hand to halt her tantrum. "That's just how war works, Penny. The rules are fluid. But you did make it through, despite all odds." That brought me to another point. "Look, as long as you have that pretty necklace, you'd better start learning to control your emotions. Witch stones have so much power that once you are attuned to a piece, it will start powering even casual thoughts and emotions like spells."
"What do you mean?"
"If you get pissed off at the chambermaid once too often, you really might burn her down before you knew what was happening. You heard what happened to Uruk. And then the servants will talk," I said, adopting the air of one of the old imperial nobility, who still thought of gossiping servants as the epitome of evil.
"Yes, you are right,"
she admitted, after blushing just a bit.
"We wouldn't want the servants to talk, now would we? But I think you'll find that I've mellowed in the last few years. A lot of that youthful impetuousness is tempered with mature wisdom," she added.
I didn't believe a word of it. The difference is that before, if you wanted to fuel a spell that could, say, burn a chambermaid alive, you had to make a conscious effort to raise that kind of power. You know that. Now, it's there, around your neck, just begging for a place to go. And it is very, very seductive. I catch myself using it even for things that I don't need to. I can see how it could become terribly easy to grow dependent upon it.
Point taken. I can see that already. When we assailed the besiegers at the keep, and I used one for the first time, it was exhilarating. I felt like an avenging goddess. And I'm not even a war mage.
Exactly, I nodded sagely. You have to be cautious with the stuff, for your own sake, as much as others. Remember what happened to Oroprat. He wasn't known as the Mad Mage of Faris because of his penchant for collecting rare art. The power of the stone drove him crazy. I wouldn't want to explain to your folks how you burned out your brain one day because you were throwing a fit. By the way, how did you sneak away from your folks as quickly as you did? I thought Daddy was being protective. Penny chewed for a few moments, swallowed, and took much longer than she really needed to chase it with beer. She stared at me sharply the whole time, and I wondered to this day just what she was thinking. Finally, she sighed and said,
"Actually, it was my father who sent me."
That admission hit me like a thunderclap. I'd met Penny's father, Master Osorio, when I had stayed at her family's estate. He was the very picture of an old imperial lineage Remiran practical adept, which is what respectable professional magi are called in Remir instead of spellmonger. He had sharp features he'd passed down to Pentandra, and an impressive, neatly combed goatee. He never failed to dress in the most expensive fine silks, and wore more gold jewelry than most women. He looked just like an archmage of old, though he acted like a social climbing adept, keen to expand his house and firm's interests no matter what. His magically talented little girl was his pride and joy. Pentandra's older sister was untalented, the family disappointment. She was also incredibly beautiful, which I'm sure was fun for Pentandra. But the admission just didn't sound like the Osorio I had met. Has Daddy been drinking again? Penny giggled.
No, nothing like that. Actually, he did not want to send me, but he was compelled to do so by the order.
Which order? I asked, there being hundreds of orders organized for chivalrous, magical, and religious purposes. There was even a mystical order associated with bakers, which my father had joined during his apprenticeship. They got together the day before Brigus Day, and wore funny hats and drank a lot of liquor. I always loved the funny hats.
The Order of the Secret Tower?
Never heard of it, I admitted.
If you had, it wouldn't be much of a secret now, would it?
She countered wryly. A good point. So why and how did the Order get your father to send you to come to rescue me? I didn't think I made that good of an impression. Actually, Penny's dad thought I was a decent enough fellow, and he respected my academic and professional capabilities, but he made a point during my visit to inform me, in no uncertain terms, that he had no desire to see his daughter allied with a common Narasi baker son with few prospects beyond village spellmonger. Her mother had been slightly less diplomatic. To her, I'd always be
that nice barbarian boy. It wasn't you, silly. It was the allure of the stones. I guess I'm going to have to trust you on this. And by telling you what I'm about to tell you, I am guilty of treason to the five duchies, violating the royal bans on magic, and could be marked for assassination by the members of the order.
I glanced over the wall, where 100,000 Gavani were lurking, just itching to see our bleached bones gaily decorate their ancestral homeland. Ishi's pretty toes. I'm really worried about being arrested or assassinated right now. She grinned, which made her look like a teenager again, and brought back a flood of fond memories from school.
The reason that the Order of the Secret Tower is secret is because a few centuries ago it was known as the Imperial Collegium of Magi, the Prince's Elector of the Archmage.
Oh. Oh!
Wait, I thought, when your barbarian ancestors crossed the Vor and conquered the Magocracy,
she explained,
it was one of only a few imperial institutions to be banned outright by the dukes. It was one of the main reasons the censorate was created. For nearly 400 years, it has been punishable by death to be known a member. The dukes thought that it had died out, but the order has been kept alive in a few of the old imperial families, mine included. We stay very quiet about it, taking a pretty passive role in politics. Mostly it's just for teaching some of the old family techniques in secret, and watching and waiting. For the last 400 years, the Order has maintained a tight organization, but did very little beyond avoid the notice of the censorate and throw regular, secret parties. When I told Daddy about the Irionite, he immediately convened the Inner Council of the Tower, and after due deliberation they authorized this fishing expedition, even funded it, under the condition that at least one piece of Irionite be returned to them.
That started my suspicions running rampant. While I appreciated the bailout, I was wary of secret groups of old Imperials plotting God's knew what kind of mischief with one of these stones. Perhaps it's the skeptical Narasi in me, but that just didn't sound like much good could come from it. There was still considerable resentment against my people by the Imperials, I knew, even though the two peoples had been regularly intermarrying for centuries, and I can't say I blamed them. While our occupation and usurpation of their country hadn't been particularly brutal, It had still been oppressive in spots, particularly against the Magi who had made our lives difficult out on the steppes. But hells! This was my country, too. I had been born here, not on some arid steppes to the north of Vor. I had no great love for the Five Duchies as a political construct, but I would hate to be called up to fight a determined group of disciplined Magi with that kind of power at their disposal. But then again, I had just handed over more power than the whole Magocracy had been able to generate in its defense to a mercenary bunch of power-hungry young Hellions, turning them loose on the world. So my moral judgment might be considered impaired. I'm sure the censors would see it that way. Who was I to judge? I was just trying to survive.
Agreed, I said finally. I think we can work something out.
Can we expect more magical reinforcements? I asked, hopefully.
No, not really.
While the council was generous, they were also cautious. If we get wiped out to the last man, then they remained hidden from ducal scrutiny, and no one will be the wiser. You have to understand how paranoid, justifiably, I might add, these people are, Min. They are masters at the long game. The Order traces its past back to Lost Perwin, and has all the patience it needs.
Great,
I sighed. Well, I don't see how I can say no, seeing as how you just saved our asses and all. I still can't believe that Osorio risked his fainting flower of a daughter in a war zone in the Wilderlands.
It wasn't easy, but Daddy is a professional. He couldn't pass up this opportunity. And it's not like I would have listened to him anyway. Besides, you know how fanatical us Imperials can be about magic. We've been using it for 9 centuries now.
And I know how you used it on my ancestors to keep us in line.
Fat lot of good it did us in the end.
I couldn't argue with that. It was, in fact, an old argument between us. Instead, I took a bite out of an apple that I wouldn't have paid an iron penny for at market, and savored the overripe juices. I was ravenous. I looked forward to my next big meal, which wouldn't be until...
Just thinking,
I said thoughtfully. Did you have an idea of how to get back out when you came into the valley?
This operation wasn't stifled by over-planning,
she said airily.
No, not really.
So how do we get a few thousand humans past a few hundred thousand Gavani without them noticing?
Hey, I'm not a war mage. You barbaric types can figure it out,
she answered defensively. Just asking. That would be a problem and one that would take quite a bit of finesse and subtlety. It would be a question of united strength and imagination of the new magic core, no doubt. A corridor of flame 100 feet high, leading to the valley's mouth. 1 million birds to fly us all over the mountains.
By the way,
Penny said conversationally, trying to change the subject, I had my valet bring my bags to your quarters and told your serving girl to see to them.
She seemed annoyed. I know that this isn't Rhymir, and these are not the best of circumstances, but you may want to have a word with her about her attitude. Or I will, if you'd like. I know you're squeamish about that sort of thing.
I stopped chewing and stared at Penny, an idiotic look plastered across my face.
Alia. She was talking about Alia.
The ramifications of Penny's arrival on a personal level suddenly leaped out from hiding and pounced on me, beating me about the head and shoulders. How does one do this? Ex-girlfriend meets new girlfriend. I'm sure you will get along famously. It was a stickier diplomatic situation than a meeting of the Coronet Council.
Penny.
That wasn't my serving girl. At least, not officially. Her eyes widened as it dawned on her what I was saying, and by extension, what she had done.
You mean to tell me that you are involved with that girl?
Yeah, a bit. Well, more than a bit.
You're blushing,
she accused, grinning wickedly.
Oh, you dear, dear boy.
I'm sorry, Pen. It's just been a long siege, and after the interrogation that your parents gave me, I figured that waiting for you would be...
Goddess! You don't think I'm jealous, do you? Me? Min, you've known me for years. How could I be jealous of...
Careful. That's my girlfriend you're talking about.
Girlfriend. And I'm sure that she's a very sweet girl, and from your reaction... I can see that you have some deep feelings about her. I think that's great, Min. You're a wonderful catch, and whether or not circumstances pushed you together, I can tell by your reaction that you obviously care for her. The feelings are returned?
They appear to be, I admitted.
I haven't any pretensions about you and me, and I have no desire to intrude in your affairs. I shall have my bags moved over to the other tower at once.
I regarded her with deep relief, tainted with just a twinge of suspicion. Penny isn't usually this gracious about such things, but, a part of me reasoned, perhaps her post-academy training had mellowed her a little.
Yeah, right,
a little voice whispered in my head. I nodded pleasantly and thanked her for her understanding, while simultaneously vowing to keep a close eye on her when she was around Alia. And now I'd have to explain things to Alia that, honestly, I didn't need to deal with right now. Perhaps I did my old friend a disservice. After all, Penny's specialty was sex magic, and she rarely formed emotional attachments with her partners. That had been one thing that had kind of bothered me, her cavalier attitude toward affairs of the heart. But then again, most of Penny's affairs had less to do with her heart than parts further south. I secretly hoped that I had been an exception. She seemed to have some kind of affection for me. But even for a lusty peasant lad, such as myself, Penny's sexual openness was a bit scandalous. My barbarian ancestors might have been lusty, but they tended to be sexually conservative, compared to the culture of the Majocracy. But imperial-style mores or not, Penny was still a woman, and women have a tendency to get territorial about the men in their lives. Perhaps you might think it odd that I was dwelling on personal problems during a siege, but when faced with the prospect of fighting rabid Gervani and negotiating a truce between two strong-willed women who both had a claim on me, well, give me a sword and let the fur fly. The Gervani are far more forgiving than a woman with hurt feelings. The next night, we struck back. It was refreshing, being able to go on the offense, after dealing with siege towers, the tunnel, and various attempts to scale the walls. It didn't take much persuasion to get Kusi to agree to it. He was far too occupied with the recovery effort and settling the new arrivals in their posts to object when I suggested a raid. He muttered something about it being good for morale, and continued his talk with the quartermaster and the castellan. Calling it a military raid is kind of dishonest. This was nothing short of a bald-faced robbery. I had a gang of eager cutthroats who were acting like parched men fighting for a drink, so anxious were they to capture more witch stones. Our scrying sentries had located at least 24 within a 7-mile area, and the only thing standing between the war magi and their prize were a few thousand goblins. The Gervani never had a chance. That first foray, we split up into 3 teams of 6 men, or women, each. Each party would venture out against a reported cluster of stones, sneak or fight their way into the enemy line, duel magically with the possessors of the Irionite, vanquish them, take their stones, and withdraw in good order, presumably doing much harm to the foe. My first outing was pretty typical. We chose a spot about a mile away from Beauvall Castle, a farmstead that had become a kind of supply depot and field hospital for the goblins. While there were, reportedly, only 2 stones there, it seemed like a strategically important and vulnerable spot to hit, a good place for newly powered war magi to try out their spurs. We used stealth spells to steal our way past sentry after sentry, in full daylight, while the camps were sleepily alive with activity. I had Azar and Hesia with me, as well as 3 young noblemen from Gilmora, 2 of whom, Mavon and Astoril, had been in the amphibious landing in Faris. We slipped through line after line of defences, clothed in a sophisticated illusion spell that made us appear to be a nondescript squad of goblin infantry on some errand. Hesia did a masterful, mistressful job of shredding the enemy wards without alarming anyone, and one of the Gilmorans magically distracted anyone who actually noticed us. We came to the little cottage that I recalled used to be the Goodman Hauks, but was now the centerpiece of an encampment vast in its own right. It took us little time to spread out around the house and prepare our spells according to the hastily made attack plan we had improvised. The 2 stones inside the cottage were in the hands of shamans who had appropriated the cot as a command center. There were 2 bored-looking sentries outside the door, but otherwise security was generally lax. Maidsight revealed two simple little wards and an alarm spell, all three of which Hesia dropped like a broken clothesline. Attacking them while they were inside was not our first choice, so we lured them outside with distracting cantrips, screams, small explosions, that sort of thing, and then pounced on them. Two of the Gilmorans cast paralyzing spells on the nearby sentries, keeping them out of mischief, while Azar and I calmly walked up to the shamans. They were the country bumpkin variety, not black skulls, dropped our illusions, and quickly cut them down with our mage blades before they could react. Hesia had thoughtfully dismantled their personal security spells before we went in, and we slaughtered them like barnyard fowl in the confusion. In seconds, we had their stones, and in minutes we were moving as a group towards the next site, even as the two befuddled sentries were trying to figure out how their bosses had gotten sliced up so viciously, right there in front of them. I think their chances of promotion looked slim. While we trekked, we had a grand old time littering the area with nasty little spells that were delayed by time, or activated by proximity, or sound, or something. We cast war magic spells of a special potency around their stinking latrines. Under the influence of the stone, I was feeling giddy with power, and just a hair sadistic. And I hope no one ever does that to me. I have no desire to have my arse burned off when I sit down on the pot in the morning. The second attack zone was a little more complex, and involved an actual duel between two shamans and Azar, while the Gilmorans and I kept the guards off of his back, and Hesia sheared off his defences like fresh wool. Azar was a wonder to behold when he was in action, plying his blade like a dancer's flag, and pulling his war wands at tactically opportune moments. He blasted one foe's head clean off, and impaled the other on his sword at the exact same time, a maniacal grin lighting up his face. For a moment I almost mistook him for war incarnate, and then he sneezed, which kind of ruined the effect. Luckily, the attack had been vicious and sudden enough that it drew little attention until it was over. Hesia had a small burn on the outside of her thigh, but that was the extent of our injuries. The final attack zone was much closer to the front lines, and centered on one particular stone. It belonged to the shaman who was apparently in charge of scrying our defenses, which made this as much a strategic strike as a robbery. With a delicate combination of distraction and misdirection, I was able to sneak up on the old fellow and slit his throat. It was almost anticlimactic, the way we stole his stone. To make up for it, Azar and the Gilmorans trashed a 100-yard stretch of Gavani fortifications dug in around their perimeter. Bolts of fire, clouds of acrid smoke, chains of magical death. It was truly beautiful to behold, in a horrifying sort of way. We quit the field and headed home before the survivors were able to send for reinforcements. That first night, Azar made a point to carve the Ilnathi rune for death in everything in sight, in an effort to instill an element of terror into the foe. The Ilnathi tribes of the peninsula were savage warriors, and their script is reflective of their delight in brutality. The Phoenician sentries did that to us, back in the war, and I know the sight of that jagged spiral made my spine run cold when I had seen it carved into a tree next to a tortured comrade. The Gavani had no way to know what it meant, but neither had we. But leaving some obscure and vicious-looking mark like that helped with psychological warfare. That became our custom in Beauvau Vale, and we didn't leave a fight thereafter without scrawling that dread symbol somewhere at the scene. From what I was able to learn later, it had a similar discouraging effect on the Gavani as it had on ducal troops in Faris. The next two nights were a nightmarish play of escalating violence, with our magi going out and hammering the enemy lines in terror raids, stealing Irionite, and littering the fields with bodies of the dead, crazed and maimed. Each night, we struck farther and farther afield, coordinating our attacks and using our best intelligence to strike where the goblin hordes were most vulnerable. We took a few casualties, but in general we were just too good for them. A well-trained war mage with a rock of green amber was almost unstoppable against any number of goblin infantry. Horka, especially, went out of his way to increase his nightly body count, employing larger and more elaborate death spells. I was almost tempted to rein him in, but upon further consideration, I decided that if there ever was a time to experiment with such wanton slaughter, this was it. I hope I won't be eternally damned for that. But then again, I've warranted damnation for so much else that one atrocity, more or less, would do little against the weight of my soul in the afterlife. Besides, I was more concerned with strategy than I was with tactics. Fate, or whatever was in charge of my destiny, had put me in command of these lethal children. That was on fate. The raids were highly successful. After two nights, every mage in the castle had his or her own chunk of Irionite, with three to spare. Everything after that was gravy, and I was holding the gravy boat. Those stones stayed in my quarters. Much to my dismay, I was apparently in charge. To be honest, half of my relief at Penny's timely arrival had been at the possibility of turning over the responsibilities of command to someone more experienced. That didn't happen, though. Most of the war magi were as young, if not younger, than I was, and the few old-timers among us were more than happy to work at my direction. They were far more used to taking orders than giving them. Even Terlaman, who looks a lot more like an officer than I do, and actually has talent for it. I was astonished that even Penny was deferring to my judgment in martial matters. I was even more amazed to discover how many of my peers looked to me for real leadership. These sons of lords and barons followed the son of a baker, without a quibble, our profession sanding away all but the barest vestiges of our original stations in society. It kind of became official at a late breakfast in the other tower, as the barracks of the Magi had come to be called. I was sitting down to polish off a huge plate of bacon and scrambled eggs, seasoned with mushrooms and precious little else, when a squad led by a young tough named Rostallo returned from their mission. I don't know if the kid was drunk, or tired, or just filled with the uncertainty and idealism of youth, but he stopped in front of my table and bowed. I nodded back, confused. We tended to be pretty casual around the Magi Towers, and resumed eating. He then cleared his throat and addressed me. "Captain Menelan," he asked. I swallowed too hard in surprise. That was the first time I had heard that title used in conjunction with my name. "Can I help you, Rusty?"
"Yes, sir. Me and the boys just got back from a little picnic, and we found some, some things of value."
He reached into his broad leather belt and took out a small cloth pouch. Upending it in front of me, he dumped a dozen and a half verdant stones on the table. Their color caught the dim light for a moment, and my heart skipped a beat. But the flash of green that bedazzled me was not accompanied by the mental tug I had come to associate with witch stones. These were raw, uncut emeralds, not Irionite. A small fortune in raw emeralds, perhaps enough to buy an estate or a poor barony, if I was any judge.
"Some chieftain of theirs was carrying it around his neck. I thought he might be a shaman, but they were just jewels."
Rosallo sounded almost disappointed.
"I guess they dug them up in their mines, away back in the mountains. Still, I didn't want to leave them there. Some people," he said, glancing accusingly back towards his mates, "wanted to keep them, but the war could see that the captain of the unit is in charge of disposing of all loot. I suppose that's ye."
I stared at the pile of pebbles that could buy my dad's village thrice over, and considered the matter. Next to Irionite, these were small beer, and considering the fact that they were nearly worthless in a war zone made this discussion almost seem funny. But the lad did have a point. So far, all the extra witch stones had been given over to me, now that every mage had his or her own. I did that for the sake of order and because my sphere was the only one able to remove the old god's taint. It was only logical that other loot be given to me for redistribution.
"I guess that is me," I finally agreed, "but maybe not. I didn't hire you, and while I did invite you, I never claimed to command over you. The war codes say that as mercenaries, you get to elect your own leader. If that's me, fine. I'll divide up the loot. If not, get whoever you elect to do it. I don't want to be responsible for duels over who got what."
Rosallo looked around at his squad, then at the others in the room, another half dozen or so who were just coming off watches on the wards and the scrying pools. They nodded to him.
"You're elected, Captain. Hell, we've been calling you Captain since we got here.
Captain Spellmonger, sometimes. Didn't you know? I shrugged. Nobody tells me anything. Which makes me perfect for command, I guess. Okay, I'll split the loot. I divided the piles into roughly equal thirds. One third goes to your squad, I dictated, and one third goes to the rest of the unit. I take the last third. Sound okay to you? If not, call a meeting and elect yourself a new captain. It was Rostallo's turn to shrug. I've got no problems with that. Hells, they're just emeralds. We could find a whole barrel of them and they still wouldn't be worth one pebble of glass. The youngsters had taken to calling the green amber they sought glass, as the young and stylish often do. I took my portion of the stones and tucked it away in my pouch. Should we ever get out of here alive, I vowed, I'd have some of them made into a necklace for Alia as a peace offering. She was just now starting to speak to me again after the argument we'd had over Penny's arrival. While I didn't think she was the type of woman to be bought off with jewelry, it couldn't hurt to try. But that served as the only confirmation of my command I ever received. A couple of the boys had taken to wearing the jagged spiral rune of death as a badge of sorts, to set them apart from the regular troops. But apart from that and our living quarters, there wasn't much structural organization. I was too busy planning and plotting to pay much attention to those I was commanding. But in the few short days the War Magi had been at Beauvall Castle, they had coalesced as a military unit, with me as their fearless leader. I had expected my comrades from Faris to listen to me, or at least not to do anything too crazy without letting me know. But somewhere between raids, I had earned the respect of the others, including these kids. I didn't realize just how seriously they took this until later. I had a hard time taking anything particularly seriously, since the old god's arrival was becoming increasingly imminent. That was a well-known, if little-discussed fact around the other tower. Under my direction, every mage in the castle took a turn on scrying and onwards, and there was no way that an Irionite-enhanced mage could fail to notice that malevolent presence getting closer and closer. If the witchstones showed up like bright torches in the scrying pools, the old god was like a blazing forest fire. The War Magi were currently happy to loot the enemy lines of Irionite. The duels with the shamans were seen as pleasant exercise, but no one had any illusions about their chances against that terrible power. Talk around the dinner table turned increasingly to packing and preparing to vacate. And they didn't even know the whole story. The secret cave that was the focus of the enemy's attention, and the major factor of the motivation of their morale. The birthplace of goblin gods that was in the heart of the hill upon which the castle sat. Nor did they know about the betrayal of the truce by Kusi's family. They found out soon enough, though. The fourth evening, I led my squad back to the gates, just before dusk, only to find my apprentice skulking about in the shadows. He wore his mage blade and an expression of deep concern, though he tried to hide it behind a stoic mask. I handed him my war staff, and began to take off my weapon's belt when Tyndall stopped me. "Master," he said worriedly, "I tried to come find you, but they wouldn't let me. You must go see Sire Kusi at once." "What's happened?" I asked, concerned. "Another breach?"
"No, Master. Sire Kusi and Lady Pentendra had a falling out."
"Did she blast him?" I asked, my heart sinking. "Damn her. I warned her about idle flashes of temper."
"No, Master," he said, his eyes wide with fear. "Sire Kusi had her arrested. She sits in a cell in the dungeon beneath the castle, even as we speak."
Chapter 13. I stage a peasant's rebellion. I found Sire Kusi meeting with a group of his cronies in the main hall of the dungeon. They were clustered around the ornate chair. I couldn't bring myself to call it a throne, in which Kusi sat, arguing and chatting and laughing and whispering amongst themselves. All of them, I noted, wore their blades, and more than half of them were armoured. There were two sentries posted at the door when we came in, Sire Kusi's regular men-at-arms, I noted, not militia or mercenaries. I was not alone myself. Wenek and Terlaman had accompanied me, eager to see the show and willing to fight, if need be. They were both armed with mage blades and war wands, and both looked imposing in their way. The glow of twilight was fading through the arrow slits, and a small fire was crackling to one side of the mammoth hearth. Kusi was enjoying a late supper of roasted capon, with a bowl of fresh fruit and cheese, along with an ewer of wine. I recognized the bottle, an old vintage from the south. For no special reason, that pissed me off even more. I pushed my way through that crowd of lackeys and stood directly in front of the seated lordling. He raised his eyebrows in that sarcastic way that even country lords affect. "Yes, Master Minolan, you have news? You wish to see me?" He knew exactly why I was there. He was trying to goad me. Bastard. "Yes, sire. I have heard disturbing rumors that I think must be addressed."
"Rumors?" he asked, pretending surprise.
"And what rumors are these, Spellmonger?" While not outright insulting, his tone was unpleasant in my ears. "It is rumored that the Lady Pentandro was lost within the castle, and found her way into the dungeon, and accidentally locked herself within a cell." There was a general chuckle among the knights and squires, though my men were silent. Grimly silent. I was giving Sire Kusi a gift here, if he were smart enough to take it. I was giving him a chance to let Penny out of the dungeon and avoid a confrontation. "I had no idea such a rumor had been started. That's outrageous. Sir Kay," he said, calling to his castellan, "have it announced in both the inner and the outer baileys that Lady Pentandra has been arrested for failure to obey an order of her rightful lord during a time of war. Let us put an end to these rumors." He hadn't been smart enough to take my gift. As Sir Kay scurried off to do his master's bidding, I did not move one muscle, though my eyes flamed, they tell me. "My lord, if I might ask, just what order did Lady Pentandra disobey?" "She refused to subordinate command of her troops to my officers. It is vital that we press home this timely advantage against our foes. With the mischief your men have been able to make amongst the enemy, we feel it is time to pressure them to quit the field. I have been preparing to mount an attack on their headquarters with an aim to capturing it. I have ordered all my forces readied for the assault. When I informed the witch of my orders, she refused to cooperate. I was polite at first, but I had to insist."
"Insist, sire?"
"She persisted in denying me what is mine by right. Worse yet, she demanded we begin preparations to abandon the castle and retreat, which caused unrest and alarm among the civilians. I had no choice but to arrest her for rebellion. I would do the same, or worse, for anyone who would impede our defense." The old bastard was smug as he said it, as if he had come up with a brilliant solution to a difficult problem. With the greatest restraint, I took another step forward, my eyes fixing on his. "My lord," I began with greatest deliberation, "the Lady Pentandra took great personal risk and expense, venturing incredible peril and spending her own coin to bring succor to us in our hour of need. At our request, we would all likely be dead right now if she had not come when she did. Leaving aside for the moment the fact that her family is a powerful one, unused to such rough treatment, might I suggest that we do ourselves and our honor a disservice by imprisoning our agent of salvation?"
"Certainly not," the old knight said scornfully. "Should I ever meet her family, I shall make all due apologies for any such perceptions. I am a gentleman, sire. But we are besieged at the moment, at war with an implacable foe, and I alone command here. I will not sit here on the eve of victory and be imperiled by the whims of one silly, obstinate girl, no matter how high-born or well-schooled. As a mage, she is not, in fact, ennobled, but a commoner, as you all are. In truth, it was her noble lineage alone that stayed my hand from more dire punishment for her defiance, and brought whatever shreds of hope of survival that we had crashing down around us," I volleyed back. "Those men you have assumed would follow you as lord and war leader are not mercenaries, Sire Kusi. They are members of her family's household guard. They will not willingly follow the man who imprisoned their liege. If they ever want to see their charge again, they had best do as I command. She is a hostage to their obedience. And your own."
"I wouldn't count on either, my lord," I said quietly. "Such dishonorable behavior stinks before the thrones of the gods, who dislike the taking of hostages.
"You speak to me of honour, spellmonger?" he scoffed angrily. "This is outrageous. I alone am Lord in Beauval. Forget that not," he warned. "All lives within these walls live or die on my word, including the lives of the Lady Pentandra, yours, your apprentice, and your peasant slut." Oh, I wanted to incinerate him, as did the war magi behind me. I could feel their loathing grow for the Wilderlord. "These are not meek men, my lord. They will not agree to such dishonorable tactics." I was at a good seethe now. Imprisoning Penny was bad enough, but insulting Alia in the same sentence? There were sparks in my hair, it was said. "You challenge my honor?" he asked. His brother, still pale from loss of blood and infection, drew his sword left-handed, as his other arm was still in a sling, and took a guardian position in front of Kusi. I could have kicked him in the knee and he would have fallen down. A few of the other Wilderlords also drew, though many looked worried and confused. Sir Kay returned, and witnessing the scene, he seemed genuinely perplexed. I did my best to stay calm and reason with the man. That doesn't mean I wasn't willing to provoke him. "Nay, Sire Kusi, you challenge your own honor by this deed. To make a man fight against his will by threatening to murder what he holds dear is as base a deed as any roadside bandit could boast of." My own men had not yet touched a weapon, but I could feel a dozen spells snap into place around me. Sire Kusi stood, his own hand on his sword hilt, and glared viciously at me. "And who are you to lecture me on the finer points of honor? A baker's son from the Riverlands with the lecherous habits of a goat. Perhaps you did serve in the wars, and your talent as a mage is clear. But blood will tell, it is said. You can dress a goat in silks, and a goat it remains. Remember your station, peasant," he spat. "And you remember your lineage, Kusi. Better the honorable sweat of flour and fire than the stink of treachery that lies on your house." Now I addressed the rest of the hall. "There is a reason there are 100,000 goblins outside the door right now, isn't there, Lord of Beauval? A reason of which you are entirely aware?" "Silence, you filthy little churl," he said, his face awash in red anger. Now he drew his blade. I kept mine sheathed on my back. "Tell your men of the shame of House Brandmount, Kusi. Tell them how your ancestors violated the truce between the Duke and the goblins, slaying them under a flag of truce in an act of base treachery. Tell them how your great-grandsire slit the throat of the goblin witchlord after he had pledged peace on his word of honor. Tell them of your house's shame." "Silence!" he shouted. The tip of his sword was quivering. I did not relent. "Tell them how his men slaughtered the females and cubs in their camps. Camps where they were assured by the Duke that they were safe from harm. Tell them how your great-grandsire schemed to steal this land from them to raise his own station." "Peasant? Silence! Or you will lie tonight in chains beside your bitch and feel the axe on your neck at the dawn." Despite his harsh words, I could see the fear in his eyes. Not the fear for his life. He was a brave man, after all. But the fear of the truth. To men such as Sire Kusi, their reputation is worth more than their lives. His brother looked even more stricken at my words. Apparently the family's history had not been shared with him. "Tell them, you old fool. Tell them where the treasure came from to build this very keep. The rents your farms pay you and your cut from the cheese merchants could not have paid for this keep in 1,000 years. Where did that gold come from? Your house stole it. That's where. Your sires wanted this land because it held a hoard, didn't it? The wealth of the goblin lords." "My lord, is this true?" Sir Ansel asked, his eyes wide. Kusi said nothing. He wasn't quite angry enough yet. So I did. "The truth. Your house was founded by thieves and murderers, Sire Kusi, and all your pretensions of nobility cannot change that. But your actions today have told you out, you arrogant old bastard.
You've proven yourself as vile in the eyes of truly honorable men as your ancestors were.
They were merely goblins! They weren't people! So the codes of honor do not apply!
He argued, as much to his men as to me.
They were innocent women and children, for all their black hair and yellow eyes. No code of honor allows their slaughter, not the Book of Huin, nor the Book of Luin, nor the codes of chivalry which you cleave to, not any code of war I have heard of. But gold is gold, and land is land, and your house wanted both, at the price of its honor. Not even base treachery would have mobilized so many Gervani to invade the duchy, though. They don't want their gold back. They want revenge. And something else.
Revenge for the slaughter?
Asked Sir Kay distastefully. He might be a dour man, but Sir Kay was an idealistic knight. It occurs to me, my lord, that such incitement may last more than a lifetime, and grow in the telling.
Tell them, Lord Brandmount. Tell them the truth. That gold came from some place special, didn't it? Not just a treasury, but a shrine. A temple holy to the Gervani, pillaged by your ancestors. The cavern of Karamala, birthplace and bridal grotto of the old god, their most sacred shrine. Somewhere under our feet is the real reason your men have died. They want it back.
They shall not have it, he declared.